This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
She's an American clinical psychologist and host of TheClimatePsychologist.com. Now Margaret Klein Salomon is calling the United States to an emergency mobilization to stave off a disastrous shift in our climate. Margaret, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to climate mobilization, how did you come to combine psychology and climate action?
I've been in a PhD program for the past 5 years. I earned my PhD in August of last year. And during my graduate studies, living in New York City through Hurricane Sandy, among other changes in the climate, and reading the news, I became more and more alarmed about climate change, and I started to write a little bit about the psychology of climate change, publish a little kind of online writing, and I thought I would start a blog. And in discussing my planned blog with friends and kind of consulting, a friend said to me, "Don't start a blog. Discourse isn't enough. Think, what could you do? What could we do together that could actually solve this problem?" And that challenge really changed my life and set me on a course of trying to strategize through studying social movements, the psychology of denial, climate change itself as a phenomenon, World War II history. And I did start a blog, The Climate Psychologist, but that blog was very focused on sharing my ideas for strategy and seeking collaboration and collaborators. And that was successful and kind of with a growing and shifting group of allies and collaborators, particularly Ezra Silk, but there's many other important contributors. We developed this strategy, organization strategy. It's kind of like I call it a startup, social movement startup, the climate mobilization, and the pledge to mobilize.
All right, so let's get to this essential idea of the climate mobilization. Do you want to give us an opening picture of what you're doing there?
Sure. The climate mobilization advocates, we recognize that climate change is a global emergency that threatens to cause the collapse of civilization within this century. That is really our starting place. What do you do in a global emergency? And what we're advocating is basically to look to history. The World War II home front mobilization in the United States is a time in our history where we successfully met a huge global emergency, which was the Axis powers' imperial ambitions and in form of World War II, where we transformed every sector of our society and economy in order to rapidly meet this challenge. And the breadth of involvement during World War II was just tremendous. It was everyone from soldiers to physicists and housewives who went to factories for the first time ever to work in a new industry, and as well as changes at home, such as during the American World War II mobilization, 40% of produce was grown at home in Victory Gardens, and business and industry completely transformed. Universities transformed in order to do war-related research. Businesses were producing armaments and war material. So the climate mobilization looks at this history and says, it's a different challenge this time, but it is an example of how we as a country and internationally deal with an acute crisis, an acute existential crisis. And what's interesting about the idea of a climate mobilization is that it's actually very well known and frequently used by climate leaders, writers, thinkers. They use this as a metaphor, right? We need to mobilize like we did during World War II. That's something that people as mainstream as Hillary Clinton has talked about that analogy. Executive directors from a long list of environmental organizations signed a letter in 2008 to Barack Obama and Hu Jintao calling for a world, I forget the exact phrasing, but it was like a war-like mobilization. It was drawn from Lester Brown. Lester Brown's one of the biggest advocates of a World War II scale and kind of style mobilization. So there's this idea, there's this historical example of how we can successfully deal with an acute crisis, and there's really this broad base of support within the environmental and political community for this idea. And yet, who's advocating for it? What environment, not just advocating, but actually pushing to realization? So that is what the climate mobilization is doing. We are advocating for this concept that is really, in many ways, I would say, a hidden consensus that we need a World War II scale mobilization. And the way that we are realizing that concept, our goal is to commence this mobilization, this climate mobilization, is through the tool of the Pledge to Mobilize. And the Pledge to Mobilize is a one-page document that any American, and recently any international person, we made an international version of the pledge, can sign. The pledge contains a political platform that has 5 political demands in which the signer recognizes that climate change threatens civilization, and they endorse this 5-point platform calling for a World War II scale mobilization that reduces, for the United States, U.S. emissions to net zero by 2025 through a complete transformation of the energy and agricultural sectors, creates full employment in the United States, and makes our top foreign policy priority to reach global net zero at emergency speed, and then to continue removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere until a safe climate is restored. So when you sign, you endorse that platform, but you also make 3 personal and political commitments. That is, I will vote for candidates who have signed the pledge over those who have not. That's any type of political candidate, local, state, national. I will support candidates who have signed the pledge with time, money, or both. And perhaps most importantly, I will spread the truth of climate change and the pledge itself to others. So in that way, it becomes like a missionary activity in which you are agreeing when you sign this pledge to go talk to people. I mean, so you can start with your friends and family. It's a way to break climate silence. So it's a way to structure conversations, initiate and structure conversations about the climate crisis, and to provide kind of a bridge between local, hyper-local, national and international action on climate, so that you can recruit, you know, the people in your book group or professional association or church to the Pledge to Mobilize. So through your closest relationships, you can have an impact on national and international climate policy.
Wow. We've got a lot to talk about, and I'd love to live so long to see all that. But in fact, it happened really, really rapidly. In a couple of years, the United States turned around. And one of the big changes was when the president told the auto industry they wouldn't be making any more cars. I'd love to see that happen. Do you think it could happen?
I think that it is hard to overestimate the psychological shift that happened in this country after Pearl Harbor and when we entered the war. And this is really an expectable pattern of human psychology. We get kind of surprised about the phenomenon of denial, but we shouldn't. We should expect it. So that in the United States, with this mounting crisis and people realizing how dangerous this was, how much and how much it was going to impact them, right? Denial is about trying to preserve the status quo, right? No, things are fine. I'm not going to have to make major changes. So in World War II, or before World War II in the United States, isolationism was very, very popular because, you know, only a few decades before, we had been in World War I, you know, very devastating war that made the country say, you know, never, never again. We want to avoid European entanglements at all costs. So that mood was really prevalent. And with it, a feeling of course I should be able to drive a car. You know, of course I should live my life for my own pleasure and satisfaction and, you know, my family. But when the United States did come under attack and Congress nearly unanimously declared war, the shift, I mean, it's just isolationism dried up. And there was this sense that you can see it in movies and books and how we remember that time. But there is this sense of duty before self and a shared effort. So could we ban the production of new automobiles? Yeah, I do think that is an achievable goal, but we first need to accomplish that mentality of realizing we cannot be just individuals here. As they say on the TV show Lost, he says, live together, die alone, right? That if each of us keeps going on pursuing our own personal goals, which, you know, could very well include having a new car, then we will face collapse and just catastrophe. But if we decide to come together to pursue the common goal that will allow for survival and subjugate many of our own individual needs, such as the desire to drive a new car, then yes, I do think it could be achieved. And another way to put it is, we must achieve it or we will experience a collapse.
Now, as you know, there are a huge number of people who distrust any government action. Does climate mobilization have to come from the federal government?
Yes, I do not see an alternative to the federal government. There's simply the scale of changes that must be undertaken rapidly. It simply could not be coordinated and executed by anyone else. This does not mean to say that the federal government would be the only player in the climate mobilization. Very much to the contrary, every sector would be a player. Businesses, universities, civil society, individuals, everyone. But it has to be planned, coordinated, funded by the federal government.
So, speaking of Congress, tell us about the bill you want to see passed.
A good start would be a declaration of emergency, or maybe an actual declaration of war on climate change, but a declaration of emergency, let's say. But it's really, really so much more than one bill. It would be hundreds of programs. We identified six themes that a climate mobilization policy would include, which are phase out of the fossil fuel infrastructure, right, just a scheduled decommissioning of fossil fuel, all operations, a renewable energy production miracle, right? So this would be legislation for making contracts with both existing renewable energy companies and, in the vein of World War II, with companies that don't make renewable energy today but could be transformed into renewable energy companies. And a national conservation project, which would include policies about, both individual use of energy and also things like public transportation on local level, on regional level, you know, investment in zero carbon infrastructure, transportation infrastructure. We need to secure the food and water supply. That primarily means a transition from industrial agriculture to small-scale local agroecology, as well as, you know, medium and large-scale agroecology. But we need to, localizing the food supply just gives us so many benefits from zero or very low-carbon supply line, if it's local, to, the ability to sequester carbon through compost and agroecology practices, to, perhaps most importantly, very important, protection against food shocks, and that we know are coming. That was, I think, 4 points. Then there's mobilize the world, which is to make climate change, to restructure our foreign policy around climate change, the way we restructured our foreign policy during World War II, around the war, and to have close relationships with our allies who are engaged in the same mobilization as us and do things like technology transfer, the Lend-Lease Act of, Lend-Lease during World War II or before we entered, supplied huge amounts of war material to England, and we also supplied the Soviet Union. So we should be similarly helping our allies around the world mobilize themselves and get to net zero emissions as rapidly as possible. And then the other theme is all hands on deck, which is to underscore the point that everyone participates in this mobilization, and that is partially through full employment, which was reached during World War II and should be reached during the climate mobilization through a job guarantee, that any American who wants to should be part of this effort and kind of the equivalent of the military, I mean, enlisting, right? You can enlist in this climate mobilization, but you'll be doing things like planting trees or insulating homes or working on rail infrastructure.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest psychologist, Margaret Klein-Salomon. We are talking about the need for a mass mobilization to fight off crippling climate change. Well, Margaret, the Republican majority in the U.S. Congress is filled with politicians who deny climate change is real or that humans are causing it. That's kind of a stumbling block, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, yes in rather the obvious ways, but no in the sense that I do think we as a movement, and especially in the media, but the movement itself too, spends way too much time trying to argue that climate change is real and that climate change denial is wrong. I think that debate is just a red herring and we should just move on. We know it's real. It's showing itself more and more every day. So I think we need to shift the discourse to, for political candidates, do you have the ability and the strength of character to protect our country and the world from collapse or not? That is really the bright line in terms of evaluating whether a candidate is climate friendly, whether they understand that this is an acute crisis that requires an emergency response, versus this quite bizarre question, do they believe that it's actually, you know, scientifically occurring, which is, of course, a completely answered question.
But on a personal level, we all need a little denial to get by. I mean, if I want to fill up my car one more time or pay that electric bill from coal-powered juice, we need to be able to turn off our knowledge of climate change almost. What tools can psychology offer to help us overcome this in order to keep functioning in a fossil-powered world?
Psychology, I mean, my field is psychoanalytic psychology, particularly, and that is a field that is focused on helping people accept conflict within themselves, to become conscious of the fact that, you know, you might both love someone and hate them, too, at different times, that both feelings can coexist, or that you feel at the same time proud and ashamed. We do live in a fossil fuel-powered world that is almost entirely inescapable on an individual level, which is exactly why we need a climate mobilization, because that is the only way we can transition our energy system rapidly. So because of that, when people come to learn about the climate crisis, especially perhaps Americans, but I think anyone, we feel guilty about our energy use and our, you know, personal pollution. And that has also really been a lot of the messaging of the environmental movement and the climate movement, has been a lot about reduce your carbon footprint. So basically, I want to tell people, don't completely forget about it. It's good to be aware that we live in a fossil fuel-powered society and to be mindful about our emissions, but I think that is absolutely the wrong place of focus, whether intellectual, emotional, or for action. Well, I think there's really been, if we took the energy that people have put into reducing their personal carbon footprint and tried to transfer that into the political realm, that would be a much more effective thing. So, I mean, I can say for me personally, you know, I'm aware when basically all the time I'm using some kind of fossil fuel energy, such as, you know, this phone call right now is, you know, I have to plug in my phone and it will charge through. But it's just not a focus. I mean, yeah, the changes we need are so great. So to come to some sort of self-acceptance that, yes, you do add greenhouse gases to this world by existing and by functioning, but to to devote yourself to say, but the greenhouse gas emissions that I inevitably cause will be in the service of creating a political mobilization on the scale that we need, rather than focusing on this very micro issue of my personal emissions.
I get you entirely. Now, as a psychologist, can you tell us some of the ways that our minds work to protect us from knowing how serious or awful the climate threat really is?
Oh, gosh. This is really kind of an incredible thing. I mean, as I said earlier, you got to come from the perspective of expecting the mind to do anything and everything to protect you from this knowledge. Don't say, oh, that's weird. You know, people's minds don't work perfectly as information processors. No, that was never how they worked. That's a computer. Yeah, we don't want to know. Because on the most basic level, because it hurts to know. It's aversive. So we put it out of awareness, and we do that in so many ways. Denial, obviously, when you just say, no, it's not happening. I don't agree. But I think just as common, perhaps more important than the phenomenon of denial, is dissociation, the defense of dissociation, which exists on a spectrum. On the most extreme, dissociation would be something like having an out-of-body experience or multiple personalities in which one personality doesn't even know what the other personality did. That's like extreme dissociation, but we all dissociate. The less extreme form is like zoning out, kind of let your mind go. Dissociation is the lack of integration, the lack of normal integration between thoughts and feelings and actions. So, you know, let's say you're in a class or something, and rather than kind of listening and participating normally, you zone out and then maybe you get in trouble. With climate change, there's so much dissociation of emotion that goes on that people understand it intellectually, and they'll say things like, oh, yeah, I know, the situation is very, very grave, and yet do nothing, this doesn't change their actions or seemingly their emotions. They talk about it in kind of a frank or like flat voice, and in this kind of conversation, I'll often say to someone, you know you're talking about the deaths of billions of people, right? Because there just seems to be missing this kind of idea. I mean, David Roberts recently wrote a kind of controversial piece about the awful truth of climate change, and I would say that there is definitely this kind of emotional numbing dissociation going on. Another psychological defense that's worth mentioning is willful ignorance, which is when you know enough to know that you don't want to know anymore. That is a way that people protect themselves. It's a defense that I engaged in for several years before I started to get to overcome it. And it would look like I would open up an article about climate change from the Atlantic or something, read the first couple sentences, maybe the first paragraph, and then just exit out. Say, nope, I cannot take this. This is too painful. I don't want to know. So yeah, willful ignorance, I think, is pretty rampant also. And that's the kind of people that says, oh yeah, climate change, yeah, that's real, that's a problem. But don't ask me, I'm not an expert, right? I haven't read anything about it. And they kind of studiously avoid reading about it because it would be difficult on so many levels.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest psychologist, Margaret Klein-Salomon. And, you've talked about the emotions, Margaret. If we really tune into what humans are doing to this planet and other species, we may feel strong emotions like grief or anger. Do you advise people to let those emotions happen or to calm themselves in various ways?
I am definitely in favor of experiencing emotions. The question is how to contain that, how to structure that in a way that it's not disruptive or overwhelming. But yeah, absolutely. If people want to cry about climate change, you should cry. Really, if you haven't cried about climate change, maybe you don't quite understand, or more likely, maybe you're dissociating. So get anger, yes, absolutely. You want to make sure that there's an appropriate time and place for that kind of experience and expression. You know, you don't want to, like, start crying about climate change in an important meeting, for example, or to, you know, become furious about climate change, perhaps in front of your young children. You know, you want to be thoughtful about it, but yeah, I mean, just in general and in this instance, constricting emotions and holding them in causes psychological problems, whereas experiencing them, letting them out, talking about them creates new planes of psychological freedom and agency. One of the kind of smaller projects that I do is run a Facebook group, or really I kind of started it and it's mainly run by other people now, but called Climate Change, It's Personal, in which it's really just a forum for the, kind of the other side of climate discussion, meaning climate discussion on the internet and generally I think is very much about, you know, numbers, scientific studies, policy targets, economic analyses. I mean, it's a very objective scientific, professional discourses. And this is a place on Facebook where people say things like, hey, are there other parents out there? How do you cope with what you know? And people talk about that. Or it just anything about you as a person living in this time. What is it like? And, you know, the least we can do is be there for each other so that you don't have to experience the climate crisis alone.
So we recently had the Norwegian eco-psychologist Per Espen Stoknes on the show. He says we have to stop frightening people with climate forecasts, which may only paralyze them into inaction. What are your thoughts on that?
I want to read more of his work and hear more about what he has to say and kind of what is the context. But basically, I disagree in that absolutely people can become overwhelmed by climate change. That is definitely true, and it is something that should be avoided. But I think that much better than not making them afraid, which will inevitably involve distorting the truth, because climate change is very frightening if presented truthfully, but rather channel the emotions, the fear, the grief, the anger, into the desperation, into a constructive solution that everyone can be a part of. My perhaps greatest hope is that the pledge to mobilize solves the problem that he is talking about, right? That when people understand how huge the problem is, that they become paralyzed. Well, not if there's a huge solution on the table that they can be a part of. It doesn't have to be paralyzing then. It can be empowering. And that is what we need, because we need people to respond with urgency. We need people to respond realistically, which is, if we don't solve this, all is lost. And if people don't understand that, don't take that in, I don't see how we can possibly expect activism to work. We need people to give of themselves at that level. I feel pretty strongly about climate truce. There's an essay of mine, a recent essay of mine called The Transformative Power of Climate Truce. It was published on Common Dreams and is currently the top story on Climate Code Red. It's also on my blog, The Climate Psychologist. And in that article, I make a comprehensive argument for frank honesty about the climate crisis, meaning if you're not talking about the fact that climate change will cause the collapse of civilization if we don't take drastic action, I think basically you're bullshit people. And in my use of the word bullshit, I'm quoting the philosopher Henry, last name escaping me at the moment, I quote him in my article, from Princeton, whose book on bull says the whole spectrum of like messaging or focus grouping that says, and you know, we've gone so into this in the United States for politics, that says don't communicate the truth. Communicate, you know, some kind of message that will kind of work for people or will manipulate them in some way. So that is a method of communication that is qualitatively different from honesty. And I think the idea that you can kind of through phrases like, you know, clean energy future or green jobs or this kind of positive outlook, you can kind of trick people into climate activism. I think it's really fundamentally flawed, and that in that we lose the enormous transformative power of climate truth, which is if we are honest and say climate change threatens the collapse of civilization, it's on us, and you know, obviously this is evidence of widespread institutional failure that we've gotten this far down. We've warmed the planet this much. We've emitted this much CO2. Our institutions are not working for us. It has to come from us, from the people living in this fateful hour. And that truth, I believe, and I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it in myself, and I've seen it in many others too. That truth can really get someone to say, this is what I want to do. And when I see people, doing things like, you know, changing jobs so they'll have more time for climate activism, or kind of in similar ways, rearranging their lives in order to put time into the climate mobilization, that is like, okay, they got it. They are they're taking in this fact of our situation and allowing themselves to be changed by it. And those people, I mean, those transformations, those transformed people, are the fuel for the kind of massive social movement that we need. Yeah, I just cannot imagine how we could solve climate change without frank honesty paired with solutions that people can engage in.
And I think that's what I'm trying to do with this radio program, Radio EcoShock. It's to say the awful truth, but then to get past that and look at what can we do. And this is the hour. The people who are alive now are either going to answer this threat or not, and we'll see. Now, along those lines, you got some inspiration from the World War II model from the book No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns. You said that gave you hope. Why?
Oh, it was the first real history I had read of what we did, what the United States did during World War II, and what we did especially on the home front. And it's just incredible. It's an absolutely incredible story. You know, that after World War I, the United States, as I was saying earlier, was in an isolationist mood, and we really decommissioned our military production. We said that people were very angry at war profiteers. They said, no, we do not want to have a big, expensive army. And so, however, Germany, after World War I, just built its war production from the ground up and focused on war production intensely. And the United States was still mired in a debate about whether tanks or cavalry was more effective for ground warfare. And there was a lot of emphasis on horses in our army in the 30s that we were so far behind. But we turned around. We collectively decided after Pearl Harbor that this had to be done. Seeing the transformation on every level, seeing the level of civic participation and things like the government would call for a rubber drive, and they would collect huge amounts of materials this way through just voluntary scrap drives. So yeah, it just really gave me a mental picture of what we can accomplish when the going gets tough. Understanding the World War II mobilization was really the only thing that I've read that gave me hope about climate change.
I kind of worry, though, that a return to military imagery has its drawbacks. Militarism is part and parcel of climate change, and It's also something that might happen when droughts, famines, or repeated extreme weather strike. Is this really the best example we have?
I do think it is, but of course, it's not a perfect example. But the climate mobilization is going to be better than the World War II mobilization because we don't have to kill anyone, right? It's not about war. It's about large-scale killing. The climate mobilization is actually quite the opposite. We are fighting forces of destruction that threaten billions of lives as opposed to... So yes, it's a rescue operation. In that way, it's better. I would say the other basic difference is that war is much easier, right? It's much easier psychologically. It's easier to sell war, right? We're evolutionarily, we're very primed to... if we're aggressed upon, we want to defend ourselves. This is a kind of a basic human tendency. So people have talked about if the North Koreans or whatever enemy was destroying our climate intentionally. Not that there's no ill intent, because surely there's bad actors such as fossil fuel companies and. Climate denial kind of misinformation think tanks come to mind. But those bad actors are not actually causing the problem. They are delaying response to the problem. But what's causing the problem is our entire economy and our entire global system right now. So there's no one that we can point to and say, we're gonna get you. The climate mobilization is going to take, in a way, like a higher level of consciousness, a higher level of human functioning, to say we're going to mobilize ourselves to save ourselves, but without this kind of easy rallying cry of us versus them.
How do you see, Margaret, this call for climate change going international to countries, say, like India, who never experienced the big shift in World War II, or maybe Scandinavia, where they didn't mobilize against Hitler? I guess what I'm asking is this really an American movement when we need a global response?
Yes. So very recently, we did introduce an international version of the Pledge to Mobilize. And as you say, we had to take out the World War II metaphor because it does not apply everywhere. We changed the target of getting to net zero to 2030 to give especially developing nations a little bit more time. But it is, so rather than a World War II scale mobilization, it's an emergency mobilization. And rather than, conduct it in accordance with the U.S. Constitution, it's conducted in accordance with the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. So it is very recent, but we have people taking the pledge to mobilize now from all over the world, and it's something we really need to scale up and, just kind of build out our website to make it to have a distinct international section. But the strategy of the pledge to mobilize, of the international pledge to mobilize, really is applicable in any country with elections. You can say, I'm going to support candidates who are going to protect civilization. That's it.
Right. The pro-civilization party. It should be every party, but it isn't right now. So these are very early days for the call for climate mobilization. What is happening now, and what do you hope for in the coming year or two?
So our big recent news is that Ralph Nader signed the pledge over the weekend. That's our first signer who really has a national profile. And in the short term, we're having a National Climate Mobilization Day, our first day of action, on June 14th, Sunday, June 14th. That is being anchored by our San Diego contingent, which is really trailblazing as far as public organizing goes. They had a march, they had a rally where they posted the pledge on the federal building, and with a nice turnout, 350 people showed up in San Diego, but they're following that up with former Congressman Jim Bates signed the pledge to mobilize, and he will be actually recreating Paul Revere's ride in the streets of San Diego, warning that climate crisis is coming and we must mobilize. So he'll be doing that, and then his endpoint will be a kind of large gathering and, rally or party or whatever it's going to be at like midnight. So they were planning that, and we figured, let's really try and amp this up. Let's call on mobilizers all over the country to do something in public, something, you know, can be, you know, hold a rally if you can, if you've got the ability to do that, or it can be as small as, you know, five people take the pledge and post it somewhere public, or, you know, we're having people tabling at farmers markets, you know, just a group of people getting out there and representing the climate mobilization. Yeah, that is it's going to be another first, just a kind of coordinated day to raise our profile and get our message out there. So speaking in a more long-term way, I mean, our timeline is really about the 2016 elections. I mean, our strategy isn't entirely beholden to the elections because we can pressure sitting elected officials to sign the pledge. However, the 2016 election is a huge opportunity in which we will elect a new president and much of a new Congress. And, you know, we have these incredibly long, drawn-out primaries in the United States, and that it, with a huge amount of media coverage. And this is really our opportunity to get the fact that climate change threatens civilization, and we need an emergency World War II scale mobilization to respond to get to carbon zero absolutely as quickly as possible. I mean, it needs to be our absolute top priority. That this is our chance to get this message into the public consciousness and to elect candidates and to really put pressure on candidates. Are you going to fight for us or not?
I think it's possible, no matter who's elected, that there could be a wave of such public demand that we could pull this off.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our strongest and, you know, really very strong asset is the truth. And it is a truth that is making itself more and more clear, more and more obvious, and more in our faces. I mean, who can look around their community and say that climate change isn't happening? I mean, it's really tangible at this point. I mean, the mood is just shifting all the time. I mean, from when I started getting involved in this to now, is something my parents have commented about, like just how what initially sounded like, you know, kind of a wild idea now seems like, oh, yeah, right. I mean, so the public opinion is shifting very quickly. I mean, Pope Francis is going to, I think, be huge in that. And the pledge to mobilize is there to provide a structured, comprehensive vision for what we need to do, and that we did it before.
Well, we've been having a great talk. We're going to have to wrap it up. Where do people go to find the Climate Pledge and become mobilization activists?
So go to theclimatemobilization.org. That is our website. Or to go directly to the pledge page, you can go to theclimatemobilization.org/sign_the_pledge. But you can probably find it from our main website.
Yes, and I'll put links to all that on my show blog at ecoshock.info as well. We have been speaking with clinical psychologist Margaret Salomon Klein, and you can find her blog at theclimatepsychologist.com. Margaret, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. We're back with our friend Paul Beckwith, and there's a common interest that we have here that I'd like to just quickly chat with Paul about. And that is this, about a month ago, I did a program on geoengineering, and I had David Keith, the scientist, a Canadian scientist, actually, who was talking about his research into it. And we also had a psychologist named Rose Cairns, who was talking about her study into the chemtrails movement, which is now prefers to call itself the anti-climate geoengineering movement. Want to be more scientific about it, they say. So these are a field of interest where, Paul, you and I cross somewhat. I know that after that show, I got some hate mail claiming that I was guilty of crimes and would be tried for it later when people woke up to the truth about spraying the skies. And I know David Keith has really been vilified for it. So there's two prime questions in my mind right now, Paul. The first one is, do you think we would know if there was geoengineering going on right now on a scale that could actually influence the climate?
That's a great question. I would hope not, because it certainly isn't working if it's being done. Would we know? I think it would be hard to hide something like that. You know, if spraying was being done, for example, you know, if the chemtrails were being done, it makes perfect sense that this would be done over the Arctic to try to cool it, as opposed to, you wouldn't do it widespread globally, especially if there were chemicals that were harmful to crops and things. You know, I mean, I'd like to see some science from those people. I'd like to see traces like chemical analysis of soils, for example, put in peer-reviewed papers showing, you know, definite high concentrations of aluminum or barium or whatever the chemicals are supposed to be. Like, a conspiracy theory is generally propagated by a small group of people. I mean, it's very, very unusual and difficult to have it propagated by a large number of people. I mean, for example, you know, you have 97-98% of climate scientists are in some conspiracy. I mean, this is completely absurd, right? I mean, we've never had any conspiracy theories that could be, you know, involve so many people. So, you know, but because the climate is changing so quickly, I mean, I can, you know, explain most of the events that are happening around the world just based on the Arctic temperature amplification and the jet streams and how that is having an effect. I can explain things with that, whereas other people that don't understand those connections, you know, are trying to invoke things like geoengineering spraying and stuff, and that just doesn't make any sense at all to me. But if somebody was doing it and it caused, you know, some crazy extreme thing someplace, how would we be able to detect that based on all these other crazy extreme things that are happening because of the jet streams in the Arctic, right? It would make it more difficult, but that would be, you know, in terms of identifying that it was happening from the result, from the symptoms. But, you know, I think identifying that it was happening from, you know, on the ground, you know, evidence would be easier to do.
Well, that's my position. I mean, we generally have a science-based program here, and I'm looking for scientists who have investigated this, have, as you say, published in peer-reviewed journals, and I can't find any to interview. So that's one problem. Now, their reply is, well, any scientist that did this would immediately lose their jobs. But my experience of scientists is there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world, and there's always somebody who's willing to go out on a limb and check out something even though it's forbidden. So I'm doubtful about that.
Yeah, I'm very it's not happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the other side of the coin, though, is you think it should happen.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and it took me a long time to get to this view. I mean, I was completely against it initially, but as the Arctic has warmed, as the jet streams have fractured and become wavy and broken and extreme weather events are taking off, I mean, this is going to get far, far worse as we go to a blue ocean event. We're just scratching the surface of it. It's going to get an order of magnitude or more worse. I mean, instead of having a city flooded out, a couple cities a year, you know, we're talking dozens of cities a year. We can't imagine. I mean, we think it's bad now. What is it going to be like in 5 years after, if there's a blue ocean event? A lot worse. And I don't think we can, it's not necessary that we allow this to happen. You know, we need to slash emissions. There's no question. I think we will eventually apply the weight of the mighty dollar, for example, the dollars that are going into the U.S. military budgets of $700 billion a year, you know, take a year and have all those high-tech companies that are manufacturing the latest and greatest in killing machines and apply them to figuring out ways to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, to get bamboo to grow at high latitudes, you know, increase kelp growth, maybe use algae for biofuels, biochar techniques for soils, you know, just extract, get those CO2 levels down. But in order to stabilize the thermodynamic system of the planet, you know, if we want to go back to any semblance of weather patterns that we had before the rapid acceleration of extreme weather events, and we need to cool the Arctic, and we know how to do that. So I've strongly felt this way. Just Google anthropogenic Arctic volcano. You know, I wrote about it many years ago. And I've come to this because, you know, you need to really weigh the pros and cons of doing it, right? And if we don't do it, then things are going to get far worse. Our weather extremes are going to skyrocket. We will reach a global food crisis because different parts, when we get a synchronization of food crop failures, then food prices will spike, and that will cause unrest, global unrest, and bring down governments and so on and so forth. So this is a very serious problem, you know. So, you know, on the plus side, I think it will amaze everybody how quickly the world governments and public changes their views on climate change. Right now, I think it would be fair to say that the vast majority of the public and governments don't see climate change as a real threat. And I think that they'll go from that position, that view, to saying, we're doomed. There's nothing we can do. We've messed it up and there's nothing we can do. Woe is us. We're all going to go the way of the dinosaurs. So it'll go to that, and then it will come back to, okay, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this. You know, we throw a lot of dollars, a lot of ingenuity, a lot of engineers. You know, we treat this as a threat to human survival on this planet, civilization survival. And then all this money that we throw at it, we innovate, we do things, and we pull ourselves out from the brink, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that don't think we can do that, including, of course, Guy McPherson and others, and they may be right, but whether they're, if they're, you know, wrong or right, it doesn't matter. We have to try to do something.
All right. Now, there was a group of U.S. scientists who have called on the U.S. government to go ahead and approve some geoengineering research, at least. Where are geoengineering discussions and research now?
I'm on some discussion groups, geoengineering discussion groups, like with scientists. So, you know, there's lots of ideas about what to do. You know, the simplest way to cool the Arctic is to put sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere, the stratosphere over the Arctic. You know, of course, that would cause cooling in the summer, in the Arctic summer, but what would it do in the Arctic winter? It could actually even cause warming in the Arctic winter. So there's schemes of using marine cloud brightening instead. And then, you know, once you shut off your devices, it completely stops. And that's to create low-level marine clouds to cool the ocean water moving up into the Arctic. You know, the biochar methods are very, very interesting. You know, kelp beds in the ocean absorb huge amounts of carbon, huge amounts. So if we can maybe expand them somehow, you know, then, you know, we could have a big impact. I mean, just stopping some of the things we're doing, like, you know, if we normally cut down so many trees per year and, you know, we stopped cutting down those trees per year, is that geoengineering? I mean, nobody would consider it that way, right? Like geoengineering, it really needs to be divided into carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management. Now, I'm saying that we have to slash emissions and we have to do both. But at least the people that are opposed to, when you talk about people and say, what are you opposed to with geoengineering, they're really talking about the idea of, say, sulfur in the atmosphere. Almost exclusively, they're saying, we can't do that, right? That's a terrible thing to do. But ask them about biochar, ask them about removing CO2 from the atmosphere, and suddenly they're not against that anymore, right? So these things are all lumped into one category, and that's a mistake.
Yeah, it's a tough one, you know, because there is a history of governments doing some really rotten things, and we find out about it 30 to 50 years later. It's finally revealed. One of my favorites was the Clinton administration in the 1990s admitted that there had been research on African-American men in the middle south Missouri and Mississippi to see what happens if you inject people with plutonium you know, a terrible, terrible thing, and they finally admit to it 30 years later. And it is possible that the U.S. military is researching this. Maybe they've got a couple of planes up there spraying something just to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. Like, a couple of planes is, you know, one thing, but changing the view of the skies across North America, as the claims are, you know, is something on a totally different scale, right? I mean, the UK had an experiment. I think they were calling it the Spice or something. They wanted to fly up a weather balloon and then have a hose running up and then spray water into the atmosphere, you know, a kilometer up or something, and that was shut down. They weren't able to do that. That was, you know, of course, we had in Canada, we had the guy dumping the iron.
Oh, yeah. Russ George was trying to feed the algae off the coast of British Columbia.
Yes, and they dumped, I don't know how many tons of iron. And the interesting thing is they had record plankton runs the two subsequent years. You know, so he was, of course, claiming that, yes, you know, the super growth of the algae, and then it was food, and then the fish went up the trophic, you know, up the food chain, and then, you know, the salmon were in record numbers. And, you know, there's no scientist has conclusively said that that's the case, but it's extremely interesting. I think it's probably, you know, what he did created those salmon runs. I think that's highly likely. So we have people doing this sort of thing. Of course, if people start doing it, right, you know, if countries start doing it and then there's a massive monsoon failure, then of course, you know, that's going to be blamed for being the cause of it, right? Like, if we were doing it and, you know, the Calgary got flooded out because of the jet streams, and then a lot of the general public can say, oh, you know, it's because of what we were doing. I mean, it's interesting to look back at the history of some of the, you know, weather modification techniques, because I think the U.S. military were experimenting ways to divert hurricanes. They were doing something to try to divert a hurricane, and then it went the wrong way and came over a city, and they stopped all those experiments, and that was all hush-hush, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, for this to ever be applied successfully, you know, the idea of we need complete transparency. We need an international group or something, but people are going to try it. You know, I think that's pretty much guaranteed.
Yes, I think it will come, and I don't know what to think about it myself.
Yeah, I mean, we have to talk about technology in that case, right? Like, I love Jacques Ellul's book, a French philosopher. He wrote some really good tech books about technology, how it develops, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And I mean, technology is really pulls society along. It's not the other way around. I mean, we don't think we need to do something, so we invent a technology for it. Usually the technology is developed and then it's applied to all these different things. Usually it's the technology is pulling along the direction of society as opposed to the other way around.
Well, I appreciate your talking with me, Paul Beckwith. Thanks again for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Get all the links for this week's interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.